Odprti termin Radio Študent.
Skrajnosti liberalizma in republika v preobrazbi. V nocojšnjem odprtem političnem terminu se pogovarjamo z Aslahan Öztürk, raziskovalko na Univerzi v Amsterdamu in gostujočo raziskovalko na Univerzi Koč v Carigradu. Tam trenutno preučuje alkohol kot vir družbenega in političnega boja v sodobni Turčiji. V svojem raziskovalnem delu se sicer ukvarja z intersekcionalnim prepletom rase, religije in spolne usmerjenosti. Kot pripadnica druge generacije izseljencev iz Turčije se udejstvuje tudi v kvirovski muslimanski skupnosti v Amsterdamu. Z Aslahan Öztürk smo se pogovarjali o nizozemskem liberalizmu v luči izključujočih se identitet, kot sta religija in spolna usmerjenost, o liberalni utopiji postrasne družbe, femonacionalističnih diskurzih ter integraciji v deklarativno strpno okolje, ki je v zahodnoevropskem kontekstu pravzaprav iluzija. Proti koncu smo načeli tudi kemalizem, z njim povezan sekularizem in sodobne neo-osmanske težnje v Turčiji.
Aslahan, thank you for joining me. Your area of research is race and religion in an interdisciplinary approach. So given the circumstances and the country where you reside, so the Netherlands, the area of your research may sound really expected or even far-fetched as we speak of the Dutch context, which is considered to be the most liberal in the world, or even being the most accepting towards different identities. And the first thing I would like to ask you, as a person of a migrant background, your parents migrated from central Turkey, how has your identity and your ethnical religious background affected you in your research process?
Ah, you're asking me a lot of questions, I think, at the same time, especially also with the context of the Netherlands. How has my background affected my research? I think there's a longer story and a shorter story to this, and I think to give a recap of my own background and my own history, I think it's pretty self-explanatory that my own life course that has been informed by the experience of my parents, how they lived their life in when they arrived in the 70s, or when my mom arrived in the 70s. She had a very rough life, I feel like, in the Netherlands. She moved with my grandfather and lived her life, I think, in a in a country that is that might present itself as very tolerant and very liberal, but it's of course I think anything but. But we can talk about that later. And I think that came with a lot of trauma as a Turkish woman for her that doesn't speak the language that well, as someone that's coming from a very working class background. Her life has been very much informed by that experience, and I think consequentially my life has been very tainted by that, like living in segregated Amsterdam. I come from New West Oostdorp, which is a part of the city that is inhabited by a lot of people with a Turkish or Moroccan migration background, guest workers from the 60s and 70s. And therefore, my experience as a first-generation student in the university has been harder, I think, to put it bluntly. And therefore, it also informed my interest, I think, due to frustrations that I had at the university and when I was like working and having side jobs at the same time. So I think the accumulation of different like microaggressions when it comes to like sexism, racism, discrimination has very much informed my interest in race and racialization, as well as issues of gender, sexuality, how those things intersect. I think simply my own experience in this body that I inhabit has informed my research in very different ways, yeah. But definitely it has had an impact, yeah.
Because the reason why I'm asking this is because many people say that this liberal acceptance or tolerance practiced by the Netherlands or performed by the Netherlands is one of the main traits of the country itself. And so this creation of a uniformal principle of a modern Western state accepting towards different nationalities, religions, different migrant backgrounds, different gender identities might come as something really normal. Mm-hmm. Or if we speak that normality is a matter of consensus, how do you think that this uniformal character of the Netherlands actually seems in practice in terms of race, religion, or mm-hmm. different identities?
I think the Netherlands is a good example of also a lot of Western European context when it comes to this like self-preservation of a very tolerant and liberal nation. But if we think of the prime example of the celebration of Zwarte Piet with Sinterklaas, in which blackface is considered to be a tradition, is considered to be something that shouldn't be critiqued just for the sake of it being a children's holiday, something that should be celebrated, and that we as people of color, people that have lived, were born and raised and brought up in a formerly colonized country by the Netherlands, it is anything but tolerant and accepting of its not considered to be normal citizens, because the normal citizen is not just like this myth of like this melting pot of the Netherlands, but it's usually like this white presenting or Dutch person that has like the roots and its history within the boundaries of the Netherlands and in Europe. I think in practice it's very different. I think the Netherlands is guilty of having this vision of a post-race society, and for this I think about the work of Alana Lenten a lot, who's an Irish scholar in race and religion, and she's been very inspired by Stuart Hall, a big figure in cultural studies and cultural analysis, and how Alana Lenten puts this is that due to its, and if we think of the Netherlands as an example, due to its trauma, due to the Shoah or the Holocaust, we'd like to think that we're over race. We've already, as a country, experienced so much trauma when it comes to racially charged and ethnic cleansing. We have learned from our mistakes, and we know that we cannot do anything like this anymore. But we also know that in the last few decades, populist parties have been on the rise, and especially with the last 5 years in the whole of Europe and the Netherlands also. A rise in alt-right politics, very fascist, but in a very kind of like intellectualizing this like culture war-esque perspective, in which racial discourse, racially charged discourse, is hidden under this umbrella of culture. So we are not speaking of race anymore, but we're speaking of cultural differences. But if you look underneath this mask of culture, underneath it all, it's race and racism and racially charged reasons as to why we should be protective over our traditions and boundaries. And it's, I think, the same narrative that is being used to protect racist histories and events and traditions, as they call it, like Zwarte Piet, for example.
As you already pointed out, the Netherlands tries to present itself as a post-racial society or a post-racial country. Mm-hmm. And with you being a part of this queer Muslim community, the queer part of this community may seem really welcome, but because it's a group, I would say a group that identifies itself with Islam, mm-hmm. which is really racialized. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How does the public or the community see this community, or have you had any experiences that are worth pointing out in this aspect?
Yeah, so I think the immediate example that comes into mind is this narrative of savior, that queer Muslims specifically are marginalized and are the ones that should be protected specifically by this like whole liberal agenda of like all these like poor Muslim people that really can't like find their way or are being discriminated against in their own context, like in Turkey, for example, or the Middle East or whatever, that like we're people that need to be saved and that we are that they feel pity for us, etc. But at the same time, Muslims, brown people, black people, we've also historically been considered to be dangerous subjects, dangerous bodies, not even bodies or humanized bodies per se, but perceived as a threat, you know. So the intersection of being queer and identifying as Muslim is something that isn't necessarily considered. People usually don't expect a Muslim person to inhabit a queer body as well, and it's considered to be an anomaly, I would say. And different ways in which this comes about, I think, is also when it comes to refugees coming into the Netherlands that use, for example, the political asylum or the fact that they identify as LGBTQ. They really need to prove that they are LGBTQ. And how does one prove to be LGBTQ? It's a very weird question to ask, but it's being taken for granted might not be the best way to put it, but it's interesting to me that we are being put in a position that we really need to make a case for ourselves, and that we are also worthy of protection without necessarily tying into this narrative of like, yeah, we need to be saved, poor us, like we want to be rescued by these white liberal people in order for us to be able to live our lives the way that we do, because we don't. We are very much aware, and I think the network that I'm part of are the most critical people that I know, because they very much realize that inhabiting this life and this body and this life course is something that we want, but not necessarily in the terms of how this how the white Dutch liberal context wants us to live our lives. Like, we don't want to be part and be pitied due to this like rescuing narrative.
Yes, especially because after the refugee crisis in 2015, the perception of a Muslim body in the Western European context became connotated with extremism and fundamentalism. And if I may present my own perception of this, that there are like Dutch people that tend to say that, yes, if you are queer, then you can't be a Muslim, because this two Indeed. Parts of an identity or parts of this Muslim queer body can be intertwined and are not inclusive. They exclude each other. And how does this discrepancy between the mainstream perception of Islam and Muslim people in Western Europe, and on the other hand, being queer, intertwine? And how does the activity of the Muslim queer community in Amsterdam, how is it affected by this perception?
Yeah, it's presented as like, again, this impossible intersection. Indeed, like, you're queer, but you're Muslim at the same time. How does that even happen? It doesn't, like, the perceptions that we have about Islam and about being Muslim does not correlate with being able to inhabit a queer body. And I think I'm sounding like a broken record at this point, but we know, and historians have pointed out, gender and sexuality historians have pointed out, that sexuality and gender was something completely different outside of the Western European context, right? I mean, the way that homosexuality was being done in the Ottoman Empire, for example, it is not something that we can necessarily compare to in the Dutch context. And we'd like to think that this like Christian framework of homosexuality being correlated to identity, or not a Christian identity, but like the genealogically speaking, in the Western context, like we think of very specific notions of what it means to be queer or homosexual or trans or non-binary. The way that people do their sexuality, do their gender, there are so many different perceptions to this. So this very narrow notion of what queerness can look like in a Western context, it doesn't necessarily apply to everyone. And I think in the queer network that I'm a part of, people are constantly struck by this interpolation of what it is like to be a subject in the Dutch context. And people are struggling in the sense that, like, just because you are open, or some people aren't open about their queerness for, like, many different reasons and very valid reasons as well. But what I do realize is that a lot of people struggle with this, more so with the expectation of queerness and, in like the Dutch context of expecting people to openly be against Islam, for example. It's really expected from a lot of people like us, where it's like, no, like, I identify as someone that, comes from a background in which Islam was very important. Some people that I know, they became even more spiritual after they came to terms with their queerness. So the way that I think we want to fill in our lives, it's only like relatively recent in which we were able to like find each other and be like, actually there is a way for us to live the lives that we want to live without it being predetermined by what queerness should look like. It's not, it can be, but it doesn't have to be like the way that people like go out and like to interact with each other, like in this very pink washing and homo-nationalistic way, right? It can be very different as well.
Where I wanted to continue. Because the Dutch politician, the Dutch right-wing populist politician, Geert Wilders, adopted this narrative that he is saving queer people in the Netherlands from this apocalypse that will consequently come with the influx of Muslim refugees from Syria and Turkey. So at the same time, being queer and Muslim, there is this person that grants your queer part of a body, this savior moment, I will save you, but at the same time, there's this animosity against the other in this same body. And how does this homo-nationalist or pink-washing discourse embody itself in practice?
Because this queer savior discourse is also, or finds its roots in femo-nationalist discourse as well. Like it's something that has developed very slowly. Because for the record, like the Dutch nation or the Dutch liberal culture or whatever you want to call it, it's not as liberal as it is, or as I don't know, queer friendly as it likes to present itself. I have to think of the way that a lot of women, for example, that were refugees, that came as refugees to the Netherlands, have been utilized in Dutch politics and Dutch discourse to be used as a prime example of how a safe woman can be integrated into the nation very well. I have to think of Ayaan Hirsi Ali, that was part of the VVD, the center-right party. Or in current examples, Lale Gül, for example, she's a Dutch-Turkish writer and debuted with her autobiographical novel Ik Ga Leven, which translates to I Want to Live. And the book has gained immense, gained immense popularity due to the fact that she is talking about her very backwards and very, she presents it as like really stupid Muslim family in which she felt very trapped and she wanted to just like smoke weed, drink alcohol, have a boyfriend, have sex, whereas her family didn't allow her to do so. And that book has traveled so much within Dutch media in which people are celebrating the fact that she's so brave and resilient to come out with the story. But at the same time, what is hidden underneath that discourse is the fact that there is only one exceptional way for a Turkish Dutch woman to live in Dutch society, which is, yes, I want to have premarital sex. Yes, I want to smoke weed. Yes, I want to drink alcohol. Which also like means that if you don't do those things, you are questioned as being a legitimate, integrated, exceptional migrants. It means that you're lacking certain embodied practices that are considered to be Dutch. And in this, you see kind of this taxonomy and hierarchy of who is considered to be a desirable migrant and who isn't a desirable migrant. And this story can also be applied to the way that queer Muslims or queer refugees, whether they identify as Muslim or religious, or that's beyond the question. It is the particular way of life that people live that are considered to be marked bodies, that are considered to be foreign bodies. If we don't live our life in a specific way, we will be questioned. We will be, we will be questioned and how to say, if we don't live our lives in a specific way, we in twijfeltrekken. It's a Dutch term. Things that we do are like people doubt us in what we do, and we are suspicious in the activities that we do, which is also again the case for people that are considered to be exceptional migrants as well. It doesn't mean that simply because you reached like this mark of like, okay, yes, you've deputed as a famous author because like you're against the religion, the family that you're from, but still, if she makes one misstep, immediately her legitimacy as a legit migrant will also be taken like for granted, and immediately like her whole position can be ruined. This happened to Ayan Hirsi Ali as well. Like
The story of Ayan Hirsi Ali, I think it's really representative in this area because she's absolutely coming from a, I think, Somali background, then migrated to the Netherlands, or she was born there, doesn't matter in essence. And then she adopted this narrative of Islam being inherently hateful towards women that want to free themselves or emancipate themselves from patriarchy. Islam being hateful towards queer people, Islam being hateful towards different religious identities or identities. And this whole thing creates a template of how a Muslim woman should be integrated into a Western European society. And she immediately, with being a politician in a liberal party that tends to produce this template, she kind of represents this ideal of a migrant. What does this implicate for other migrants that don't want to be integrated in this inherently secular or almost forcibly assimilative way?
I think I would want to be careful with the term secular, because at the same time, secular does not, secularism finds its roots in Christianity, in the way that the state has been developing in Europe. It's not a neutral term as people might assume, or an objective term as people might assume. So when it comes to like the secular framework, we really should be aware of the fact that it doesn't necessarily implicate the neutrality and the liberal position that people might think. I think in the previous anecdotes, I kind of answered this question. It's it is in an anecdotal sense a confusing place to be, because there's only, you're exposed to only this one way of living a life, and when you deviate from that life, you're considered to be ungrateful, for example. You're considered to be ungrateful for the opportunities and the safe spaces, for example, that the Netherlands has to offer, or in my case, Amsterdam has to offer. So I think it's I think for a lot of people like me, people like tend to struggle to really find a way to live on our own terms, in the way that we want to live our lives, not necessarily wanting to associate with like correlating like living a queer life in which is expected from us, in a queer life that we want to live it. Queerness also, I feel like, and at least in my case, I don't want to speak on behalf of other people, of course, but queerness is inherently political to me. And it's, the personal is political, right? So for me, how it affects me is, for the longest time, it was a struggle, in the sense that I just wasn't sure like how I was able to translate how I felt into how I wanted to position myself in my case, like, for example, the university, how I live my life as a student at the university. And only later, until I read more into gender and sexuality and queer theory and literature, and stumbling upon this network, I was able to see and learn, like, there is a way for us to live our lives. But maybe I'm repeating myself over and over at the moment.
We were speaking about secularism, and we can't continue this interview without mentioning your ethnical background and how it connects to secularism. So your parents migrated from central Anatolia near Konya, which is one of the most religious cities in Turkey.
Considered to be the most religious. Let's be political here.
And what I'm interested in, you grew up in the Netherlands, which is liberal in the sense that it tends to present itself as being tolerant towards different religious identities and affiliations. But coming from, I mean, your parents coming from Turkey, which has a secular constitution that wants to be alienated from Islam because of the sake of westernizing Turkey. I think you are in a really interesting position between being from a liberal country and from being your ethnical background being from a country that's that was forcibly secularized and produced another uniformal template for a person that has to be westernized.
Of course, I come from a specific family in a specific context in Turkey, in which I think my father was and can be considered as someone that I would consider him very nationalistic and having specific like secular values. Also, in the case of the Netherlands, by the way, my dad always wanted me to integrate into Dutch society. That's like really what he expected from me, but just with a grain of salt, because again, this is my own experience and I can't make any inferences to and for other people that have like a similar life course to me, because you know, this is intersectional. It relates to class, it relates to like how my body is being perceived, etc., etc. So that being said, I think one of the ways it has manifested in my personal life, because my dad was someone that really, again, like considered himself to be quite nationalistic, he prioritized like having a good integration for the sake of having a good life for me, specifically for me and my sisters, in which for me, how that manifests is the fact that my Turkish is worse than the other two languages that I am able to speak well, which is Dutch and Turkish, or Dutch and English, sorry. I wish it was Turkish. For the sake of being integrated well, me being very familiar with Dutch culture. I even went to a Christian school, for example, so I have way more knowledge about the Bible than the Quran, which is very hilarious to a lot of people. But it was a very deliberate choice by my parents to pay specific attention to how I adapt to my surroundings and adapt to the context that my parents have decided to migrate to. Well, not decided to migrate to. Of course, those things are more complicated and more coercive than that. But it was a situation that we ended up in, and they really made it a priority that me and my sisters just had a good livelihood and had a good job and had a good education. And that is still something that they talk about every day. Like, I want you to be independent and I want you to be able to live a comfortable life. But also this like question of like being stuck between East and West, right? Like, oh my God, being stuck between like modernity and tradition. Of course, it's like inherently very binary way of thinking. It's not that simple and it's not that straightforward as people might present. Like, Turkey is a very great example of how fluid these things are. Like, it's an enormous country with enormous different ways of living, of perceiving itself, in which you have like this very top-down institutionalization of course of secularism, but people have lived their lives the way that they've been wanting to live it for the past only century of the Turkish Republic. It's only it's not even 100 years old. I think they're celebrating their, yeah, it's going to be 100 years in a few months already. So,
but that being said, and since you're currently a research fellow at Koch University based in Istanbul, we were speaking about migrants in the Netherlands and the possibilities of integration and the implications that come with it. Turkey, as a secular country, also received a huge flow from Muslim migrants from Syria, Afghanistan, and other Muslim countries in the Middle East and further. And the secular notion of Turkey also tends to create a template for integration because the majority of bureaucratic positions are still taken up by secular people, even though the government is trying to neo-Ottomanize Turkey. And in the Turkish context, how would you say that this secular constitution affects the Muslim migrants in the contemporary sense?
I think I'm convinced by the fact that there is a racialized taxonomy of bodies in Turkey, in which, you know, the more white presenting bodies are considered to be superior over Kurdish populations, for example, or other, or even Central Anatolia is considered to be less, or considered to be more backwards compared to people from the West Coast, for example. So, in that way, secularism, and with this course of history in Turkey, still shows today in the ways in which, take for example the very popular like film series Recep İvedik, where you have like this very hairy, fat, supposedly like not very hygienic and kind of blunt person being a character that we all laugh at, and it's all inflations of stereotypes that we have about Kurdish people. And this just taps into like kind of the cultural archive that we have in Turkey, or in the Turkish context, in which we consider Arab looking people, how we, or the way that we perceive bodies that we read as more Arabic, they're considered to be bodies that are less good than the Turkish, maybe supposedly like Kemalist body. And of course, this comes with a lot of nuances, and it's of course more complicated than that. But I am convinced that in the research that I'm doing, where I look at race, racialization, critical race theory, that the way that we can kind of translate this scholarly template onto the Turkish context is a way in which a similar imperialist, colonialist history is still showing today. And it's in different ways than in the Dutch context, of course, but the sheer fact that the Western modernizing, civilizing template by Mustafa Kemal Atatürk still creates genealogical traces, palimpsest-esque, in the way that people are being perceived every day. And for example, the history of Istanbul, historically speaking, many people from Central Anatolia, from the southeast of Turkey, they travel to Ankara, to Istanbul, to work, and they have been marginalized, they've been exploited, they have been considered to be less than compared to the people that were actually from here, and that were, I would say, like, would be considered as Beyaz Türk, that white Turks, that have had a lot of like good positions within Turkey. But the nuance that maybe and perhaps comes with this is also the current rise of neoliberal Islam in the Turkish context. I really, really love Evren Savcı's work on this. She wrote a book called Queer in Translation, and it's a book that I really prize and have learned a lot from and I'm inspired by every day. In which also this nuance is created, where it's not necessarily the Beyaz Türk, Türkler anymore, the white Turks, but it's also this growing group that is affiliated with the party, that is gaining more of a dominant position in the country. So things are a bit shifting with regards to how, historically speaking, people have been hierarchized in Turkey.
There are prejudices against Arabic people in Turkey, and this change from Beyaz Turks, so white Turks, to newly Islamized Turks, doesn't really help the prejudices. It doesn't delete them. It's
it's such a complicated history. It would be, I think, impossible for me to really answer this in the way it deserves to be answered. I think the current developments of, or the recent developments in Turkey in the last 20 years have really complicated the history and the perception and the change of race. But inherently speaking, like, race and racialization is something that changes over time. And it is considered to be a floating signifier, right? Like, it changes and it adapts to the context that it is in which previously considered to be deviant bodies. So, for example, in the 20s, when Kemalist policies were put down into the Turkish Republic, certain dress codes were prohibited, like, for example, the fez was prohibited to wear, the wearing of the hijab, the headscarf, or the başörtü too was not necessarily prohibited at the time, but was considered to be unprofessional. It was discouraged to wear them in public, in which you had, like, this whole, and I'm, like, at the moment also staring in Matthias' room right now with, I think, an old newspaper of, it says Çalışan Kadın, which means working woman, with a very specific and propagated attire in which, like, you don't have the headscarf, you have jewelry, you have, like, very professional attire with, like, a pencil skirt. It was a very different way of presenting yourself that was considered to be ideal, and was considered to be this ideal type of Kemalist of Kemalist citizen or Kemalist subject. So at the time, you had this one deviant body, but currently this is changing, but also the connotations and constellations of race and religion is also changing with that. So right now, it's not this, like, the Kemalist body, or, like, people that would self-identify as Kemalist right now, it's a very different position. Like, these people themselves currently are self-proclaimed minorities. They feel threatened, and they feel like they're dying upper class. Also considering the political economy of the country, these people that were previously more, like, upper middle class are not as prosperous anymore, economically prosperous as they once were, in favor of people that are affiliated, I suppose, with AK Parti and the party, and how the perceptions of different populations in the country, how they're perceived, or in the sense that, like, people previously identified, like, Beyaz Türks, consider that people that are affiliated with the party are becoming more prosperous, to recollect my thoughts, just repeating that. When it comes to refugees, this is just yet another, I feel like, migration flow that complicates this issue, because you have yet another population that is easy to be othered. It's people that are either affiliated or supporters of the party, as well as Beyaz Türkler, that are complaining in Istanbul, for example, about tourists from Iran or refugees from Syria. They're complaining about them all the time, just telling us, like, look at Fatih, like, I never go to Fatih because it's so incredibly busy. And Fatih is the, like, one of the most historical like, places of Istanbul, and like one of the places where a lot of tourists go to all the time. And it's also, like, coming to a point in which, like, you really don't even have to initiate a conversation with a person, but they literally just tell themselves, we just sit to an old Turkish teyze or a lady, and she is just minding her own business and asks us, oh, where are you from? And I'm telling her, like, oh, my parents are from here, but I was born and raised in Amsterdam. And they're like, yeah, all these Syrians are really, like, ruining the city and the country. So,
and it's not a uniformal like a population that reproduces its prejudices against Syrian or Arabic migrants. We can't denounce these people as being exclusively secular or as being exclusively fans of the current government. Mm-hmm. I think it's rooted in the Turkish society in like a really broad sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the crumble of the Ottoman Empire was a huge trauma for the country, and it's, I think, partly, of course, not completely, but partly also explains this the agenda of the current AKP-led government, in the sense that it was considered as a loss, and the way that the Turkish Republic kind of came over that trauma was through the implementation of Kemalism. But yet it still remains a scar and a trauma for a lot of people that live within the Turkish context. And how that manifests is, I think, this complex of inferiority with regards to the West. And I think that is the main thing that I am interested in, because Turkey has always inhabited this like very cliche-esque presentation of East versus West. Like, it's a country that is stuck between, again, tradition and modernity. But it does, I think, tap into the psyche of Turkey, in the sense that it is taunted and haunted by this history and this fear, I think, of being behind the West. And it has always been something that has been lingering. I think it has happened with like the coups, but also the fact that, I mean, AKP used to be incredibly popular also amongst like queer people and leftist people in the very beginning of when the party came into power, because it had this very pro-Western liberal agenda, which was celebrated by a lot of these people. And only later, when these things became seemingly complicated and more complex for Turkey, and by a lot of people, it has been explained because of the fact that Turkey was not considered Western enough, they switched gears. Like, the government and its policies, they decided to go the opposite side. But it's motivated, I would say, by this trauma that is rooted in the crumble of the Ottoman Empire, which has been related to, again, this Western imperialist agenda, right? Like, all these things are very much interconnected. So again, very complicated and very difficult history, I think.
You've mentioned a couple of times that there is this perception of Turkey being between tradition and modernity, and an important symbol of this discrepancy between tradition, the perceived discrepancy between tradition and modernity, is something which you're currently researching. So, alcohol as a symbol of Kemalist revolution. Mm-hmm. So, can you tell a bit more about how you're taking up the alcohol in the connection to race and religion in Istanbul currently, where you're research fellow at Koç University?
Yes, I find it really funny that you're saying Kemalist revolution. I think that's not how I would present it, I think. But to me, I think how I came to this topic, I can explain later. But to just give a quick recap of what I do, I look at the constellation of race and religion in the Turkish context. And this is a huge question because of its very complicated and very multifaceted history. So one of the ways I am planning on and currently working on to kind of, I don't know, trying to trace down this this race religion constellation in the Turkish context would be through alcohol. I'm not sure if this is the exact right place to look at, but for now, this is what I'm working on. And I think alcohol becomes very fascinating and interesting because it's a very explicitly subversive act often. So how can we understand this? There is a constant taxation of alcohol because it's behavior, and it's a good that is being discouraged, morally speaking, by the government. It's considered to be something that shouldn't be spent money on. So hence all the specific taxation on alcohol, specifically making it very expensive to go out and have a beer. It's more expensive to go out and have a beer, by the way, in a bar rather than getting it at the shops, but nevertheless. And what makes this subversive act very interesting is that it has a very explicit relation to the current political economy of Turkey. So therefore I end up at alcohol in the sense of, like, how do people do this behavior? What do they think of being together, spending time together, when it is considered to be immoral in Istanbul. For example, we have the clubs are supposed to close down after 1 a.m., but if you know your way around, you know and do find places that are open after 1 a.m. You do find bars that are open after 1 a.m. So people still like find different ways to be subversive. And also the consumption of alcohol becomes interesting due to the fact that though it is a subversive act, because you spend so much money on alcohol, the money that you spend also still ends up at the same government that you're trying to be subversive against. So what I just do right now is look at the way that people engage in these activities, but also consider themselves either to be morally, maybe, you know, trying to be better than, I don't know, non-drinking people. But of course, this is still a working hypothesis, and I wouldn't want to make any inferences yet again. But I will say that indeed, like this changing of the way that different generations participate in nightlife and I don't know, hedonistic activities, maybe, it is very telling in the way that they present themselves. Like it's that's also what makes alcohol very interesting, right? Like it's a very explicit act, or at least drinking in public, like it's a very explicit act of identifying with the state in a very particular way. It doesn't necessarily say much about religion, because one can still identify as a Muslim and still drink, but yet it has specific signifiers that we can relate to race and religion, and that we can relate back to the things that I've mentioned before.
Let this last thought sink in. Aslihan, thank you for joining us at Radio Student na frekwencji 1963. Thanks again.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I hope this was interesting. Yeah.
Ostanite na naši frekvenciji in se slišimo.
Odprti politični termin je pripravil Matija. Uvod sem bral Rasto, tehniciral je Toljo.